Anya, come take a look at this.
Anya pushed herself forward through the brush. Wait a bit, thorns tugged at her sleeves. She wished she could summon up the sword and chop them all back and be done with it. It wasn't appropriate, but it would be gratifying. They were getting close to their destination. Sporadic rain, last gasp of the monsoon, had made the forest footing mushy, even though today was fair and hot. Anya's sense of urgency was a constant neural buzz. They had come upon what looked like a road through the woods. The hardwood trees were widely spaced. It looked almost as if a path had been bulldozed through brush and a stand of saplings, transversely to their own course. But even Anya, no tracker, could see no signs of the tearing and gouging a track-laying vehicle did to such soft ground.
What's this? An elephant trail?
Too wide. It'd take a herd to do this.
The women looked at Eddie, the guide, and Phil Kennedy, who had lived and worked among the tribes in this region. They looked at each other.
Men made this.
Eddie took off his Dodger's cap and wiped sweat from his forehead with the back of a hand. His normal ebullience had definitely flattened.
Are you a tracker?
No way. But I do know what a path made by a bunch of guys on foot who don't much care what kind of mark they leave on the environment looks like.
Wouldn't elephants leave signs like knocked over trees?
And their feet mush up the ground more.
Anya took off her sunglasses and put them up on the front of her boonie hat.
So, who were they?
Like I say, I'm not a tracker.
Tribal people move carefully. They leave few marks.
I'd say it's an army. Or a militia. Whatever.
Militia?
Ethnic army. Drug army. Bandit gang. Any of the above. All of the above. Take your pick.
To the extent there's a difference.
Exactly.
Great. Well, I'm guessing these are people we don't want to cross paths with, so to speak.
Eddie seemed to be sweating more than before, even though he wasn't exerting himself.
Whether they're worse than their government forces is kind of an open question. The important thing is, we don't want to find out.
Anya stood a moment with hands on her hips. She noticed some trash trodden into the pathway, little plastic wrappers from snacks or cigarettes.
Well, at least they're going a different way.
They were when they passed by here, anyway. Do we know where they were going?
Everybody looked to Eddie, even Phil. He was, after all, the man with the best line on Myanmar's famously large and cantankerous ethnic armies. His eyes were big.
You got me. Wouldn't I have to be, like, psychic to know?
This could have been just part of a larger group, too, headed out on patrol or maybe even coming back.
How do you reckon that?
Patty jerked her head at the trail.
No tire tracks. Any self-respecting gang of thugs is at least going to have a pickup or a Land Cruiser or something for their big boss to ride around in.
Maybe.
We need information.
We need out of this area. We can move faster than a big mob of men on foot, can't we?
If they're not real elite or moving with real purpose, probably so.
But we don't know for sure. Do we really want to risk blundering into them? Or their main force, if Patty's right and this was just a patrol?
Or their enemies, for that matter.
Maybe we should find out who's who, then. Don't the Arabs say, the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
Maybe that works for the Arabs. Around here, not so much.
Not so much in the Muslim world either. I think the proverb was meant to apply to temporary alliances.
Yeah, and what if these guys' enemies are the Myanmar army? They're not our friends for sure.
Phil spread his hands.
You're all making my case for me. We need to find a village and find out what we can.
Okay, now what?
The four crouched in the brush behind a fallen tree trunk. Beyond it, a small cultivated vegetable patch was visible. Anya could make out the sharply peaked roof of a small wooden temple above the trees a couple of hundred yards away. A village lay nearby.
I guess we might as well talk to them.
That would be my job.
Phil gave a covert side glance to Eddie Chen that Anya caught.
Why you?
I know this area. These people are Diang. They speak a Mon Khmer dialect related to Cambodian. I speak it as well. Do you?
Eddie scowled. He didn't. Anya already knew. For the past couple of days, a mostly friendly rivalry had developed between Phil and Eddie. Phil, Anya suspected, felt challenged by Eddie's superior knowledge of the Tibeto-Burman languages used in some places they'd passed through. Under other circumstances, the irony might have amused her. He had been behind Eddie's hiring, after all. Anya didn't care. She mainly wanted Kennedy for the cultural work necessary to document and start in motion proper preservation measures for the Temple of the Elephant. His relationships with certain groups whose territory they had to pass through on the way were a potential plus, not the reason for hiring him. Eddie was their guide and main liaison. Flies swarmed around them like biplanes buzzing King Kong. The smell of the human excrement that was the main fertilizer for the little garden overwhelmed the usual jungle odors. It was no improvement. They all looked to Anya. Even Patty's face was paler than normal and taut beneath her sunscreen and the brim of her floppy hat. Her mouth was set in a line. No wisecracks for the moment. Anya drew a breath down into her belly, which did little to calm either pulse or misgivings.
Okay, Phil, but for God's sake, be careful.
What's there to be afraid of? These people are peaceful. You Westerners regard all pre-industrial people as savages.
Phil straightened and stepped over the log. The brush crackled as he swept through it. Anya winced.
Chumriapsu!
Phil staggered and sat down. His head started to loll. Blood ran from the side of his mouth. With unspoken accord, Eddie and Anya grabbed him under the arms and dashed back into the brush with him. He was dead weight. His long legs dangled behind, boot heels plowing up humus and catching on things. They stumbled and bulled through brush for 50 yards, 100. Patty ran before them. She'd dart ahead a few yards, then stop and wait, panting and visibly quivering. Anya wasn't sure whether to feel gratitude that she hadn't abandoned them or shout for her to save herself. Patty had stopped with hands on thighs and was staring back past Anya.
Oh, shit. Voices, they're chasing us.
Put him down, Eddie.
They eased Phil Kennedy down beneath a bush. She didn't hold much hope for his survival, but she didn't want to finish him off herself. She started back at an angle to the direction they had come.
Anya, wait!
If Patty had anything more to say, the green brush closing behind Anya swallowed it. She took for granted that if the SPDC caught up with them, its agents would either shoot them on the spot or take them into custody and interrogate them. Either way, they'd end up dead. She had often heard and read that when outnumbered, fighting back was no option anyway, so there was no point going armed into enemy country. Lacking firearms, they could only flee from those who had them. But Anya had an edge. The last thing her pursuers would ever expect was that their fleeing quarry might double back to ambush them. Anya was determined that it would indeed be the last thing. As Anya emerged from the brush, Patty looked up from where she knelt over Phil Kennedy. He lay stretched out full length, with his head propped on his own backpack. His eyeballs gleamed dully under half-lowered lids.
He's gone.
Anya knelt and placed two shotguns on the grass. Patty's eyes went wide when she saw them.
What about...
They won't chase us anymore.
She bent close to feel Phil's neck. The skin was clammy, no more elastic than putty. Cool, despite the late afternoon heat. There was no pulse. Anya gently pressed his eyelids closed.
We'll divide up what we can of his load.
Patty nodded to the two shotguns Anya had laid down. One had a swirly pattern, incorporating something like a mandala, picked out in its shoulder stock with hammered-in brads or tacks. The other was wound with brass wire, holding together a broken stock and keeping the barrel attached.
What about those?
Anya shrugged. She reached in a pocket of her khaki cargo pants and pulled out four shotgun shells. They were brown, greased paper, smudged and stained, with faded black printing on the sides and tarnished brass bases.
The guns are loaded. I've got these extra shells, French. They're old, you can tell from the wax paper hulls. I won't swear the guns won't blow up in your face the next time they go off, but the charges and the guns work.
What good would that do us against Tamadol rockets? Or even ethnic army AKs, for that matter?
How much good did bare hands do us?
Eddie jerked back as if she had slapped him.
Do you like the feeling of utter helplessness, getting chased through the woods like that? They probably thought they'd got lucky, bagging spies to sell to the chief of whatever bandit gangs working the area, or the SPDC. Will you feel better if we get ambushed again and all we get to do is throw rocks?
Guns don't make us bulletproof.
Hold that thought. What they might do is give us a chance we wouldn't have without them. But they are a burden, and could be as dangerous to you as anybody you're shooting at. Your choice.
What about you, Anya?
Anya knelt and began pulling the pack slowly from beneath Phil's head. If the apparent callousness shocked the others, well, it wasn't as if poor Phil was going to mind. Anya had enough experience with corpses to know that, if they didn't.
I don't need guns. I've got other options.
Two things hit them halfway up the 100-foot cliff to the mesa where the lost temple complex awaited. One was torrential rain, the drops exploding like little mortar shells on the red rocks around them. The other was a patrol from the Grand Shan State Army. Patty was the lead climber. Anya was poised 10 yards beneath Patty. Eddie was a few feet below her, perched on relatively large and stable outcrops, while the red-headed photographer hammered in pitons to belay their safety lines. Despite her years, Patty Rule climbed like a monkey. The burst hit somewhere too far to be visible. Patty shook her head wearily, glanced at the jungle, then looked down at the others.
Shit. I'm definitely getting too old for this.
Then she turned her face resolutely from the danger on the ground and began to climb swiftly and purposefully. More cautiously, Eddie and Anya, neither a seasoned climber, followed her. Anya never knew what happened next, whether it was the torrential rains or the impact of Patty's piton going into a fissure in the yellow rock or the photographer's weight.
Rock!
As Patty fell, Anya felt an impulse to grab for her. She restrained it. The combined mass of Patty and the rock to which she was already bound by the rope was far too great for Anya to make any difference. In fact, it ripped the pitons above Anya right out of the cliff face as it plummeted. Anya flattened and threw herself to the right. As she did, the corrugated rubber soles of her walking shoes lost their purchase. She dropped a foot to slam and then hang, spitting helplessly from her own safety rope. Patty fell past. She caught Anya's eye. For a moment, time seemed to slow. Anya's frantic brain formed the impression the older woman winked at her. And she saw, even in the overcast and the rain, the wink of bare steel in the photographer's left hand. Her son's knife. Time resumed. Patty and the fatal rock plunged away with sickening speed. Whipping above them was a cut end of the white and blue rope, severed by Patty in a final act of incredible sacrifice and presence of mind. Tears streamed from Anya's eyes, mingling with the rain. She sought for and found a purchase for her shoes. When she no longer swung freely, she secured the rope. As safety backups, both she and Eddie carried rock hammers and pitons. There was no help for her friend. Already, men in dark clothing and blue headbands had begun to filter out of the brush, cautiously approaching the crushed body of the photojournalist, as if suspecting it was bait in an elaborate trap. Turning her face away from her fallen friend, Anya blinked away the tears and rain. She began to climb.
We made it.
Anya could hardly believe it herself. They stood atop the mesa that rose from the Shan Plateau. As if by cosmic irony, the rain had ceased. In front of them rose a green wall of jungle. Several miles farther on, jutted a fang of bare red rock. On its top stood an unmistakable weathered structure, possibly carved from the peak itself.
A temple of the elephant.
It's real! I can't believe it!
Anya grinned at him. Despite the exhaustion she should have felt from the desperate climb the rest of the way up the cliff, she was elated. At their feet lay their backpacks, including Patty's. They had hauled them up on ropes after reaching the top. Anya frowned. She walked to the edge and looked down. A knot of dark-clad men had gathered at the cliff base. They surrounded Patty's body. One of them stepped cautiously forward and prodded an outflung hand with a boot. The hand flopped as if attached to a rubber hose. The men closed in and began to tug at the body. Clearly, they were grubbing for loot. Rage filled Anya. They had not caused Patty's death directly, but they had shot at them without reason. And if that additional hadn't caused misjudgment that led to Patty's death, it had contributed. Chunks of rock lay near the cliff edge, weather split from an outcropping. Anya's eye lit on one about the size of her torso. She squatted, bowed her back, and sucked in a deep breath. Grasping the rock by the ends, she deadlifted it, driving upward with her legs. It almost felt easy. Anger was engorging body and mind with a fresh blast of adrenaline. She straightened her back and heaved, pushing with her thighs. The rock rolled outward from the clifftop and then dropped toward the knot of men swarming over Patty's corpse. Now there were three bodies at the foot of the cliff, and the rest of the men were scattering into the jungle like cockroaches. Anya stood looking down upon them, flexing and unflexing her hands. Eddie stared at her, with jaw hanging so slack it might have come disjointed.
You meant to do that.
Anya nodded.
You're not just an archaeologist, are you?
Anya stooped to the packs. Her mind had already returned to the urgency of the situation at hand. They'd take any supplies they'd really need from Patty's pack, any documents or small personal effects. Then they'd cash the rest, as they had Phil's, along with his body, lacking time or energy to bury him. Although he'd doubtless prefer returning his stuff to the jungle he loved, whatever the jungle left of him, Anya had vowed to herself to see recovered and return to his family. Silently, she made the same promise to Patty. If she survived, of course. Death canceled all debts. An archaeologist, whose study was, after all, the dead, knew that better than most.
No way!
A partial wall of red stone and exposed brick filler a good 15 feet high stood before them. It was so vine-twined and overgrown that it looked as if it had itself sprung from the earth, grown up as part of the living jungle itself. For a moment, Anya didn't understand Eddie's reaction. Then she realized he was still astonished to discover that the legendary giant temple complex really existed. Of course it does, she felt an urge to say, with a touch of irritation. But part of her empathized with him. Eddie was an engineer by training and inclination. Lost temples and fabulous treasure hoards were only myths in this modern world of satellites and cell phones. Confronted by one impossibility made undeniably real, the temple on its crag, he was still struggling to accept it. Anya realized she was unprepared to document their find. She had one of Patty's cameras in her pack and went to dig it out.
This is just the beginning.
You mean there's more?
That's what von Heuningen claimed. I think we kind of have to believe him now, don't we?
I've got to see this.
The relief here was relatively flat. The obvious choice for a quick vantage point was to scale the ruined wall. Eddie quickly shed his pack and clambered up with his usual agility. Anya frowned, concerned from a preservation standpoint.
That might not be a good idea.
Ignoring her, Eddie reached a high point on the wall, where the stone outer sheathing was still intact. He stood upright.
My God, Anya! You're right! It's like it goes on for months!
Choking back an exclamation that could only risk drawing the eyes of the unseen shooter, Anya darted around the wall stub. Eddie lay on his back with his knees and forearms up. His eyes were wide behind askew glasses. The burst had taken him right across the chest. Kneeling over him, Anya could see at least four entry holes in his blue polo shirt, surrounded by spreading patches of darker fabric. He caught her hand, and the blood bubbled up from the back of his throat and ran out his mouth and down his cheeks.
Anya, tell my father I'm sorry.
Squeezing his hand in both of hers, she dropped her forehead to it. The tears streamed hot down her cheeks. She had not yet had time to grieve for Patty, or even Phil. And now she had three times the grieving to do and no time to do it. She dragged Eddie's body under some brush. It was the best she could do for him. Then she ran, hunched over, around the rock, brought his pack, and shoved it next to the body. Behind her, a flight of birds burst skyward. Someone was approaching from the cliffs. She had to move, now. Her choice of direction was obvious. She fled deeper into the mesa, into the overgrown temple complex, and toward the red peak on which the Temple of the Elephant stood. Eddie had been turning when he got hit. Anya didn't know which direction the shots came from. Moving as quickly as she could, with some degree of quiet, she became aware of more ruins around her. Some were wall stubs, like the one Eddie had incautiously climbed. Others were segments of walls of larger blocks, fallen into jumbles. She saw apparently intact small buildings, or perhaps surviving rooms, some mounded with overgrown earth, inviting with blank black windows or low doors. Anya passed these by, recognizing them for what they were. Not bolt holes, but traps. She had no way of knowing which, if any, had other exits. She darted through a gap between walls. On her left, a second stump of wall joined the other. A corner turned buttress when the rest of the chamber fell away. She stepped into the niche thus created. It gave her not just concealment, but cover from two directions, including the way she had come. It was neither a safe nor a satisfactory position, just the best available chance to get her breath back and come up with some sort of plan. Cautiously, she peered back through the gap. She could see nothing but forest, with occasional glimpses of stonework. She heard nothing but the normal jungle sounds. She could almost believe she had the mesa to herself. But someone had shot Eddie Chen. Someone close by. Very few shooters were skilled enough to keep full-auto bursts on target at any range at all. Muzzle jump and parallax usually meant so many shots from one brief burst couldn't hit a target even from 100 yards or less. They would have dispersed too widely. If Anya were very, very lucky, whoever killed Eddie had no idea of her presence.
Yeah, as if I'm ever that lucky.
Anya! Anya Creed! The phrase almost jumped out of her skin took on a whole new meaning for Anya. She jumped a foot straight up, twisting in midair like a cat. She landed, trembling violently. The dark, shiny face of Easy Unguenya peered at her from a stand of green bamboo 10 yards behind her.
Anya, thank God you're here. I've been hoping against her.
You murdering little bitch!
Easy's dark eyes widened. She only just managed to duck and roll away as Anya swung for her head. Easy rolled and snapped to her feet with practiced grace.
What on earth do you think?
You killed them!
Anya aimed a kick at the crouching woman. Easy flung herself to the right.
Who?
All of them!
Anya ran toward her. Easy darted behind a small tree and ducked as Anya swung and missed again.
Oh, who?
Sir Sidney. Isabelle Gendron. My friend. Who knows how many others?
I never touched a hair on Professor Hazelton's head. I've no idea who Isabelle Gendron is, and I... Holy shit!
The uncharacteristically vulgar exclamation burst from the young woman when the upper half of the tree she hid behind toppled abruptly to her right, crashing into some brush as unhappy monkeys bailed in all directions.
How did you do that?
Anya hacked at her again. The blade went halfway into the stump and stuck fast. Easy dodged away.
Maybe you'll listen to reason now. I've killed people, yes. I've killed some today, as it happens. But I sincerely doubt any of them were remotely friends of yours. Die!
Anya had dislodged the blade from the grip of the green wood. She raised the sword above her head, preparing for a mighty stroke. As she did, Easy rolled into view on Anya's right, lying on her back on the short, clumpy grass. The muzzles of her twin Sphinx 40-caliber auto pistols were like unwinking black eyes staring into Anya's.
Now we've arrived at the standoff phase of our program. I know no handgun bullet will prevent you splitting me like kindling with that bloody great pig sticker, but it will be a dead or dying hand that splits me, I assure you. So for the love of God, can we talk?
That might be a worthwhile idea.
Anya felt the heat of muzzle flares and stings as bits of unburned propellant struck the exposed skin of her arm and cheek. She did not launch a dying stroke, because a preconscious part of her mind had registered how the young woman had twitched the firearms a few degrees aside before pulling the triggers. Anya spun. A small man in dark green clothes and a blue turban sagged toward the gap between the wall fragments. His bare forearms were twined with tattoos. Unfortunately, as he went down, a dying reflex triggered a harmless skyward burst from his AK-47.
That's torn it! Run!
Easy took off on a course that led into deep brush, straight toward the mesa's center. Anya saw no choice but to follow. Easy seemed to slip between the branches, and her boots landed lightly on the forest floor mulch. Anya was acutely conscious of blundering like a rhino, but it made little difference. Anya had fired Kalashnikov's full auto. She knew a person doing that didn't hear much else. Stealth was no issue. Speed might well mean life. Easy turned sideways as she ran between trunks, flanking the faint game trail she followed. When she passed through, she almost casually extended her left arm to its full length. Anya squeezed after her. A figure collapsed forward out of a scrim of brush, a rifle falling from limp brown hands. This one's head was wound with a yellow turban. That surprised Anya. She was pretty sure all the goons she had seen so far wore dark green uniforms and blue headgear. She wasn't going to ask any questions right now, nor get answers to them. The reconnaissance by fire had calmed down behind them, probably because the shooters were reloading. Occasional random bursts still ripped the heavy evening air. All Anya could think to do was stick as close to Easy as possible. At least she seemed to know where she was going. Without visible effort, Easy vaulted a fallen log arching 3 feet from the forest floor. She kept running. Two men suddenly appeared behind her from a bush. They wore yellow headbands. They raised M16s after the running woman, who hadn't noticed them. At this range, Anya knew the gunman could hardly miss. The closer man turned to look over his shoulder. Anya slashed backhand diagonally right between wide, shocked eyes staring from a mustached face. Anya didn't break stride. A running horizontal forehand cut took the second gunman right at the back of his sweaty neck beneath a yellow turban. Anya ran past, never glancing his way. Anya put her back to a tree and slid down. The rough bark of the bole rasped her skin through the light shirt she wore. She paid no attention. They had not run that far, no more than a quarter mile, she guessed. But it had been across broken terrain, the lushly overgrown forest of the Mesa Top between increasingly sizable spills of masonry. And it had been high stress. Nothing sucked energy out of your body as fast as combat. Even though they had seen no sign of actual enemies, since Anya had cut down the unsuspecting pair getting ready to shoot Easy, her body had stayed on alert the whole way, jumping over tangles and bouncing off trees. Now she felt as if she'd kickboxed 10 rounds and run a marathon. Easy squatted on her haunches. Anya almost felt relieved to note the younger woman was panting like a dog as well. Easy mopped at the sweat streaming freely down her high, round forehead with a rag. It mostly redistributed the wetness. She took a canteen from her belt, drank deep, then tossed it to Anya without asking if the other woman wanted it. She didn't have to. Anya threw the canteen back to Easy.
What the hell is going on?
She was trying to control her breathing, but it took a huge force of even her strong and well-practiced will. Easy drank again. She seemed to have her own panting under control already.
Blue turbans. Grand Shan State Army. Marshal Chang Sha, proprietor. Self-proclaimed marshal, unquestioned warlord. Ethnic resistance army, but mostly gangs. Chang Sha likes walks at sunset, Irish whiskey, and sticking his enemies' heads on poles. Yellow Turbans are Lord's War Army, recruited from a tribe of backward inbred war. It's politically incorrect to call them headhunters, although that's exactly what this bunch were. Until they got converted from animism to fundamentalist Christianity by their current spiritual and military leader, Jerry Cromwell.
Jerry Cromwell?
Foreign name because he's a foreign bloke. A Yank, as it happens. Former cable television preacher sort of chap. Apparently made carloads of money off the faithful in his day. Big on Armageddon. I understand he left the States in rather a hurry, ahead of a slew of charges.
Great. Another disgraced televangelist. He converted this WA group from being headhunters?
I didn't say that. It was animism he got them to give up. The headhunting? Maybe not.
I'm not so sure the modern Shan bunch are much better. Heads on poles, how nice.
Oh, they're not, of course. But I suppose they'd argue that their head-taking is intended to send a message. Politics of meaning and all that. Whereas the WAS is recreational. Much more civilized, as it were.
Anya grinned. She found herself liking this brash, brave young woman, whom, she recalled to her chagrin, she had been trying to kill a few minutes ago, whom she had accused of multiple murders herself. She tried to recoup that righteous, avenging rage. She couldn't. Maybe it was just the fact she was so drained physically and emotionally. Maybe it had something to do with the fact she had just killed two men who had been trying to kill Easy Unguenya. Then again, Anya didn't doubt for a nanosecond that they'd have killed her as quickly. Easy looked at her with her head angled to one side.
Not so eager to vivisect me anymore, then?
I don't know what's going on.
Easy let herself sit all the way down.
I have a bit of a line on local news, having been on the ground, as it were, these 2 days past. And wondering, I'll admit, what was keeping you.
She grinned. Anya felt a stab of irritation. But she could still muster no more than that. She was as befuddled as she was worn out.
But I admit I'm in a bit of a bother over why you were hollering about my murdering a lot of strangers while trying to reduce me to my component parts, if you'd care to elucidate.
Easy waved a dark hand invitingly. Anya nodded.
All right.
She explained quickly and tersely the trail of corpses she thought Easy had left behind her on her search for the Temple of the Elephant.
Oh dear, I can see why you'd be holding a bit of a grudge.
Easy's eyes were huge and round. It made her look 14. She tightened her lips and tipped her head to the right again.
So, why did you stop trying to kill me? Or not simply let that pair shoot me? Yes, I sensed something was going on and glanced back. By that time, one was down and the other's body was falling, so I put it from my mind and concentrated on flight.
Anya looked at her a moment.
You could have shot me back there if you wanted to. For that matter, you told me to come along with you when we ran. You let me follow. It would have been easy for you to have left me behind in the meat grinder back there.
Right. I admit I'm still a bit unclear on the concept of why you leaped to the conclusion that I was guilty of all that sordid homicide.
Well, we're after the same thing, aren't we?
As we were in China. And I didn't notice either of us strewing corpses in our wake then.
Well, you're a criminal, frankly. You're the world's most notorious tomb robber. Given your disrespect for the law, how was I to know what was beyond you? Especially since you make such a show of going everywhere armed.
You're a fine one to talk about that. But as for my being a criminal, is Yan Gon officially apprised of your presence in the happy land of Myanmar by any chance? Thought so. Do I need to point out how copiously you're in violation of the SPDC's laws? I doubt you've reported the deaths of your comrades, even poor Dr. Kennedy. That's another slew of violations right there.
Yeah, but the SPDC is a brutal dictatorship, and its laws are unjust.
Meaning, not to your liking. You're quick to condemn me for flouting laws I disagree with, yet here you are, blithely doing the exact same thing.
Anya's cheeks flushed hot.
But you're desecrating valuable archaeological sites, destroying context and stealing the priceless heritage of the local peoples.
Exactly what claims of ownership local peoples have to these artifacts are tenuous at best, especially given that the artifacts were usually left behind by some other group altogether. As often as not, the local people's contribution to the relic's provenance was to move in and slaughter their creators wholesale. And how often do these local groups get to keep their relics, ancestral or not? Doesn't the government almost always swoop in and carry them off?
Yes, but they're official caretakers.
Oh, so's the Tatmadaw Ki. And you seem to have a firm grip on the kind of care they take. Are you really that sheltered that you don't know how often the artifacts you see in the museums or even in crates in the basement are replicas, often not even good replicas, of objects sold to government-favored private collectors? And haven't you read any of the documentation I've written? I've never disrupted context, Anya. You should know that if you've done your homework.
Well...
Anya shook her head. She knew Easy was right. But somehow she couldn't muster the arguments to demonstrate the facts so that Easy would have to face them. Somehow they didn't seem to matter, right here, right now.
Does anybody ever win an argument with you, Easy?
You know, my father took to asking that very question in the last few years before we stopped speaking to one another altogether.
So what now?
If you're on for a bit more of a hike, then let's go along and meet the folks.
The folks?
The protectors of the precious elephant, who've guarded this mesa since the Bagan Empire fell to the Mongols 7 centuries ago.
Many ages ago, the kingdom of Bagan ruled over Burma.
The speaker was a man severely shrunken by the decades, who probably hadn't been big to start with. His face was full of seams and wrinkles. His white beard, though silky and growing to his navel, seemed to consist of about a dozen hairs. Firelight danced on the faces of towering blocks of stone, and on the faces of the people clustered between them. These were anything but stony. The assembled villagers were alive with eager curiosity and anticipation.
In those years, many were the temples they built, and glorious. And none more glorious than the temple of the precious wheel. And above it, the crowning glory of the temple of the precious elephant.
The onlookers had to have heard this story 100 times before. But Anya knew that just as few people ever got tired of talking about themselves, fewer still got tired of hearing about themselves. And this was the story of the people of this lost, jungle-clad mesa rising from the Shan Plateau. The protectors, as the people of the mesa called themselves, spoke a Burmese dialect. But either they all also knew English, or they knew the story enough to know what was being said.
For centuries, Bagan ruled wisely and well. Then came the people from the north, the Mongols who ruled China. The princes and the leaders and the monks went away to fight with them. So great was the arrogant pride of Naratihapate, the great king, that he led his armies into Yunnan to meet the enemy. That pride was the downfall of Bagan. The Mongols defeated the forces of the king. His own son murdered him. The Mongols invaded and conquered the land.
He paused as if to draw breath, shaking his head as if in weary regret of the follies of the past.
Those of the nobles and monks who had not left to fight and fall alongside King Naratihapate fled to the capital, where in due time the Mongols crushed them. Before leaving here, our masters charged us to guard the holy places. Not against wood, nor wind, nor water. These things would work what they would work, and their working would in time help to hide this sanctum from the wicked. We were left behind to defend these sacred things from the hands of desecrators, and so we have. No Mongol who set foot upon the plateau lived to take the tale back to his Khan. Nor has any foe since. Yet now, we are beset from two directions at once. And so, we face the most bitter fight of our history, or the dishonor of defeat.
The people rose to their feet, waving their fists.
I wonder what Phil would have made of them.
They were certainly isolated, simple tribal folk, to all appearances, pre-industrial enough even for a purist like Dr. Kennedy. Yet far from being pacifists, they seemed eager to confront their lowland enemies, and not with protest songs and garlands of flowers. The village lay 2 or 3 miles in from the edge of the steep-sided mesa, and about 0.5 mile from the jut of rock on which the Temple of the Elephant perched. The ruins beside the plaza rose to a watt of impressive dimensions. It was so thoroughly shrouded in jungle vegetation that from any distance, or even from the air, it would seem nothing more than a natural hill. Anya knew that was probably why the ruin had escaped detection for so long. The dwellings were perfectly integrated into the tangle of worked stone and riotous growth. The protectors seemed to make no use of the remaining enclosures. Instead, they wove their huts in among them. These, too, were cunningly worked, incorporating living limbs and vines in the roofs and very walls, so that they were hard to spot until you were right on them. The villagers lived off fruit and small animals from the jungle, and by working hundreds of dispersed garden plots so tiny and irregular that even from the air they wouldn't be discernible as cultivation. Obviously, avoiding aerial detection hadn't been part of the original intent, but after a century of aviation, Anya suspected the villagers had adapted to improve their overhead security. They struck her as smart, resourceful folk. Though she was no social anthropologist, she knew the study of these people and their society would be as fascinating and fruitful in its way as exploring the entire vast complex of ruins. Enthralled at hearing their own story, the villagers seemed to have forgotten the outsiders. Easy sat beside Anya. The younger woman was smiling and shaking her head.
It's ironic, you know.
How's that?
These people aren't warriors, or at least their ancestors weren't. They are descended from the builders of the temple complex, the people who designed and physically built these enormous structures.
Oh.
They made the perfect caretakers, of course. Over time, the other people who hadn't run off to join the army or fled the Mongols probably wandered away or simply starved. This mesa won't support a large population. These folks are just barely at the point of maintaining sufficient genetic diversity, although there's intermarriage with tribes from the surrounding plateau. And people from here often go into the outside world, sometimes returning with spouses or at least children. They and their culture and the whole Watt complex aren't lost so much as hidden.
Don't they have trouble when some want to leave?
Surprisingly, no. They lose some that way, of course, but their culture keeps alive a sense of mission. I believe they're awaiting the return of Gautama, or reincarnation of Vishnu as Maitreya. Like a lot of Buddhists in this part of the world, they mix their faith up with the mother religion pretty liberally.
Through the compact binoculars Easy Ungwenya had handed Anya, the men in the dark green, not quite uniforms, and blue turbans looked like roaches climbing the cliff's red face with the aid of piton-anchored ropes. The two women lay on their stomachs on a high point on the cliff, 150 yards or so to the west. The invaders had found a groove worn through the rocks so that they were able to climb at an easier angle, but it was still risky. The Grand Shan State Army had no idea how risky it really was. Out of sight beyond the head of the cut, a trio of small, wiry protectors, wearing drab sarongs and headcloths, worked diligently at a tilted slab with pry bars and chisels. The red sandstone was prone to fracture along a plane, the same phenomenon that had killed Paddy Rule. As Anya watched, a flat piece of rock the size of a Volkswagen chassis suddenly shifted and broke free. The Shans raised their turbaned heads to see doom accelerating down at them. It smashed the top two men outright. The man right below turned and jumped down reflexively. A bad move, given that he was about 60 feet up. He bought himself about a second more of life. The stone slab was constrained in the channel the men had been climbing up. Banging off the sides in pink sprays of rock dust, it smashed two more men off. Then it struck an outcrop, bounced, went end over end away from the cliff. That spared the half-dozen men below it in the chute. However, it landed on two more waiting their turn to climb from the ground below. The more prudent turned and ran. The protectors, for their part, acted like pros. They didn't indulge in any boastful, triumphant display. They just turned to make their escape. A Shan militiaman on the ground shouldered an RPG. The grenade struck near the top of the outcrop. Vaporized copper from the shaped charge head and a spray of shattered rock blasted the nearest protector in the back. He fell on his face, thrashing. His comrades grabbed his arms to pull him away. The right one came off in his companion's hand. Anya jerked back from the binoculars. Beside her, Easy grimaced.
Oh, hard luck that.
Maybe we'd better shift out of here, too.
Although they'd been careful, Anya realized, with a sick shock, she couldn't be sure she hadn't been spotted from the ground. Although with the sun over their left shoulders, there was little chance of a lens glint giving their position away. She also did not feel like betting her life. That had just been a lucky shot.
These aren't helpless farmers, you see.
No.
But here's the cold equation. The protectors have about 100 effective fighters, including some pretty young and pretty old. The Lord's War Army is bringing 4 times that number against them. The GSSA, almost 5. Our friends had every advantage in that ambush. But a lucky shot by a Shan militiaman did greater hurt to our side than a well-conceived and executed ambush did theirs.
Anya grimaced in dismay. She had felt nothing but exultation over their victory, then grief for the loss of a brave man. What Easy told her now sat in her stomach like badly curdled milk.
If they had modern weapons, and the sort of near-infinite resupply it takes to use them in battle, the protectors could dig in along the heights and stand both armies off forever. They lack such weapons. Don't like them, actually. They fear becoming dependent upon them to fight effectively.
And you agree with that?
Oh, yes, in this particular instance. That kind of Gallipoli-style stand would work an even greater disaster on them. The noise of a protracted firefight would surely attract the attention of the Tatmadaw Key. And I doubt I need to tell you what would follow then.
No. So why the sudden interest in this place anyway?
Coincidence, it appears. Marshal Changsha, the GSSA Supremo, has taken it into his head that this would make an ideal base of operations for his drug-running operation, as well as his war with Yangon. Unfortunately, Jerry Cromwell and his war have got the same notion. Of course, Cromwell has an additional agenda. He's declared the temples and all the relics within them are abominations in the eyes of the Lord and must be expunged.
Even though they're mostly ruins.
Apparently, they're not ruined enough. So he wants to dynamite the lot and then use the mesa as a base to spread his brand of Christianity across the Shan Plateau and presumably all of Southeast Asia.
So he wants to give this archaeological treasure the same treatment the Taliban gave the statues of Buddha at Bamiyan?
Exactly. It's ironic, really. Cromwell gets financial support from certain right-wing fundamentalist groups in the States because he claims to be battling Islamic terror.
You mean he doesn't fund his operations through drugs, the way Changsha does?
I didn't say that. Truth to tell, I don't really know. Still, one thing I've noticed about true believers of every stripe, being utterly convinced that you know the real truth, the only truth, and nothing but the truth, doesn't translate to decent behavior the way everybody thinks it does. Rather, once you start from the standpoint of unassailable righteousness, it's no trick to rationalize any atrocity whatever, so long as you claim it's directed against the wicked. It's even possible both commanders believe the mesa will provide them a stronghold secure against the full might of the Myanmar armed forces. I think that's a faint hope myself, but they'd not be the first to think that way.
I don't think there's much hope at all. What about the protectors? What are the invaders' plans for them?
Changsha is looking to enslave them, I gather, based on past performance. Cromwell feels that protectors of pagan abominations... Oh, and in this case, in more ways than one, pagan is the old spelling of the kingdom now known as Bagan, are themselves abominations in the eyes of the Lord, hence worthy of extermination.
Chalk up another moral victory for religion.
Oh, yes. Militant atheists like Pol Pot and Mao Zedong would never engage in large-scale genocide.
Do you ever get tired of being right all the time?
Oddly, my father used to say that too.
I'm beginning to empathize with him.
There's not really anything keeping us here.
Do you feel like abandoning these people to their fate?
No. But then I have what might be seen as an overly sentimental fondness for tribal people, especially since I am one myself. Then again, I hate injustice. I don't care to see these brave people crushed.
You hate injustice? But what about your disregard for the law?
Do you really believe law and justice are the same thing? And as I've asked before, if you really believe so strongly in hewing to the letter of the law, where's your permission slip from the SPDC?
All right, all right. It's just that your activities...
My tomb robbing, as you'd call it, my pot hunting, all those other flip pejorative phrases you academic archaeologists use to reassure yourselves that you're righteous grave robbers, while those whose methods differ are not.
Anya winced. Yet she had to admit there was truth in what the younger woman said. At least a little.
We have a different conception of what's right, perhaps. But am I wrong in believing you possess a strong urge to defend what you feel is right? And are our differences really that wide, at least where human decency is concerned?
No. No, I guess not. But should we let ourselves lose track of why we're both here?
What do you mean?
You came to seize the golden elephant, didn't you?
Yes, didn't you?
That hit Anya like a sucker punch.
I did.
She had gotten so wrapped up in her conviction that her race with Easy to the Temple of the Elephant was a primal contest between good and evil that she forgot she was trying to grab the idol too, for profit, to sell to the mysterious private collector who had contacted Rue. Of course, now that the secret seemed to have gotten out, she could say she was only trying to keep it out of the clutches of the Yangon government. But didn't she believe national governments were the righteous protectors of their people's heritage? And how about the near-total certainty that the State Peace and Development Council would melt the idol down, the Bagan people and their heritage be damned?
Are you all right, Anya? You've gone rather ashen.
An acute attack of conscience. Never mind. We do need to know where we stand, though.
Relative to...
each other. And the idol.
Fair enough. I'm willing to bind myself to do nothing toward recovering the idol until the people of the Mesa are safe. Or until I've died trying to keep them that way. As for the idol, there's time enough to settle that when this thing's resolved and we both stand before it. And I am also willing, if you are, to give my word to do my best to make sure we both come to stand before the idol of our own free will and on our own 2 feet.
Why should I believe that?
Why believe the other, then? We can do this the easy way, or...
She let it trail away with a little smile. Anya frowned. Nothing she knew or had seen of Easy's actions indicated that she did things without reason. And once she had spoken to Sir Sidney, or even if, despite her denials, she'd talked to Isabel, what point would there be in killing them? Anya wasn't sure what the point would be for anyone to do so, and that was a loose end that bothered her. But the fact was, having met Easy, listened to her voice, seen her body language, looked into her eyes, Anya believed her.
All right. I'll swear. How do guys handle this kind of thing?
With some ridiculous homoerotic ritual. Why not just shake hands? Or would you Americans cross your hearts?
Anya looked at her a moment. Then solemnly, she crossed her heart. Easy did likewise.
Well, now there's the question of what we can do to help the villagers, except die futilely and bravely at their sides, which is hardly useful.
Wait. The Protectors seem to base their whole strategy on hit-and-run attacks, traps, and ambushes.
The classic resource of the weaker defender against the stronger invader. Also, they work.
And they have for almost 1,000 years. But what if that's too long?
For success...
Easy grinned, and once again looked even younger than she was.
Oh.
We can let go of the comforting neo-colonial illusion of being superior minds from the West come to save the savages.
Ouch. I resemble that remark.
But what we can bring is a fresh perspective, yes?
After almost a millennium, a habit of thinking can be tough to break.
My point exactly. Never before have the Protectors faced 2 powerful and determined foes at the same time. And I think their long strings of successes may just be blinding them to the obvious.
I have to admit I was blind to it too. But now that you rub my nose in it...
It's pretty obvious, isn't it? To an outsider.
Yes, so it is.
The only problem is selling it to the Protectors.
Oh, don't forget, the Protectors are well aware of the modern world. Some have even lived in the United States. They may disdain modernity, but I believe they also overestimate its abilities and powers. A fact we can shamelessly exploit. To their advantage, of course.
Isn't that a classic Western neo-colonialist attitude?
I never claimed to be perfect. Come on, Anya. Are you in or out?
You know I'm in. I guess I'm not perfect either. Sometimes I have to admit, the old ways are the best ways.
Hardly a radical thought for a professional antiquarian. The Lord's Wa Army carried mostly American-made equipment, prominently M16 rifles. Anya suspected they had been funded, at least, by the CIA. The grenades that dangled from their web gear had a made-in-America look to her as well. However they got that way, they were well-armed. The Wa Patrol seemed ridiculously incautious. Maybe they believed God was keeping a special eye out for them. In which case, he was just about to blink. Anya didn't see the hidden trigger. Then again, neither did the point man. A 4-inch-thick sapling that had been bent until its top touched the ground snapped upright into his face and body. The trunk had 18-inch wood spikes jutting from it. His comrades dived off to both sides of the narrow game trail they'd been following. Some of them stepped into small concealed pits and were pierced by needle-sharp slivers of bamboo. The patrol's poorly trained, panicked members open fire, aiming at least 10 feet too high. Anya and her escort of four grinning protectors slipped away through the brush.